This is Channel One Over. This is Channel One Over. This is the beginning of Channel One Over. This is the beginning of Channel One Over. This is Channel One Over. This is the beginning of Channel One Over. The beginning of Channel One Over. This is the beginning of Channel One Over. And this is Monday morning, the 8th of December. Monday morning, the 8th of December at breakfast. Monday morning, the 8th of December at breakfast. Channel One Over.
Well, I don't know what I was going to say, guys. I really don't.
That's right.
It's different. The...
Now, the cold-blooded makes thugs.
Plugs. Old plugs. They all, I don't know. You know, you hear these things as a breed, and it's true. As a breed, the thoroughbred is willing, intelligent, or completely stupid, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
You're either highly intelligent or completely stupid, depending on who you talk to. And has lots and lots of heart. He'll just go forever. And that's why he's either highly intelligent or completely stupid.
No. What was that?
Till he drops dead.
Yes.
And you figure that to some people, a horse that'll run until he drops dead isn't very smart.
Yeah.
But I've worked with them now from different ones for ever since I was about 16. And the first one I ever rode was Bold Ann. And she was a hunting mare, a hunter. She'd been used as a hunter all her life. And she was one of these mares that had been worked so long that she thought she was a... She'd forgotten she was a mare. And when they finally decided to breed her, they couldn't. She just kicked the stallion to pieces and walked off. So, Oh, they do. They get those mares. You work, especially the thoroughbred mares. You either breed them early and then work them until they're getting on and then breed them again, or you might as well forget it. They won't take to a stallion after they've gotten 8 or 9. If they've been worked all their life, really worked, they're too good for it. They get proud. They won't have anything to do. They're like old maids.
Mm-hmm.
They're not gonna have anything to do with male of the species.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, Bold Ann was like that, and I've seen Sonata, Judy's mare at the Tilts, wouldn't be bred. She was a working mare. And I've heard a lot of horsemen say it's true. They've seen it before. But Bold Ann had the only problem with Bold Ann was that she wouldn't walk. You had to be very, very tactful to get her to walk once you were up. But she was as kind and willing. And oh, she did love to jump. She was 21 years old the last time I jumped her. She had arthritis, and then she'd get it in the winter, and she'd get it so bad she could hardly step over the stall door. And then it'd clear up in the summer. And Miss Staley, it was in a lesson, Miss Staley asked me if I wanted to jump her. I said yes, and she said, "Well, you can, I guess, take her on the outside course. I don't guess she'll get too stiff tomorrow." And so I started her off, and there was a 4 or 5 jumps in this outside course. It wasn't anything very big. They were set at about 3-6, and that old mare jumped. It was the best round I'd jumped on her in a long time. She was 21 years old, and we had the most beautiful round. She stood back from every fence and moved like a young horse, just moved, smooth and really at going for her fences, going to be beyond them, you know. And we drew up, and Mrs. Daly looked at her, and she said, "I wish I had five more like her. Oh, I wish I had five more like her." That was the last time she ever jumped. She got stiff the next day, and Mrs. Daly said, "Well, we won't jump her anymore." It was a good round to quit on. Mm-hmm. And I took her to a hunt later. Mrs. Daly would take her hilltopping, which didn't involve any jumping, but she wasn't really even up to that. And one day I wanted to go watch the Christmas hunt off. I didn't want to hunt. I just wanted to watch them off. So I rode. Even if you're going to watch the hunt off, if you ride over there, you have to dress. So I got my black coat and stock and rode over, saddled up Bold Aaron and rode over there, and we watched the hunt off. She was all excited. Not uncontrollable, just excited, watching everything. Standing quietly like she knew she was supposed to, and watching and walking around with some of the other horses and looking at the hounds. Oh. And then the hunt moved off. And she waited, and all of the riders went past us, and she began to worry a little bit, chew the bit. And then the last rider went past, and she stepped forward to step into her place, because she'd been going last for a few years now. Mm-hmm. And I said, "No." And she read it. And I was so heartbroken. I was so sorry I took her. She wanted to go so badly. And we waited around a little bit, and the hounds bayed, and oh, she was so upset. She'd walk around in circles, and she'd throw her head, and she'd whinny after the other horses, and I wouldn't let her go. So we turned around and started home, and she would not walk home. She was going to show she was young enough, and she pranced all the way home.
Oh. And she was thoroughbred.
Oh, she was thoroughbred to the core. She was a fine example of thoroughbred.
She was a purebred?
Oh, yeah. Registered. Now, I met some thoroughbred giraffes. There was a giraffe at camp. There are these horses with great big high withers and dropping quarters that drop down behind them.
Yeah.
And I swear they look like giraffes. And this one looked more giraffe-y than most. And besides that, he was stupid.
He really was?
He really was. And if he hadn't been worked, you'd get on him and you'd ride him out there, and he'd be walking quietly around, and all of a sudden he'd go, "Rrr!" And he'd fuck up and go as high as he could, but his withers were so high that it didn't make much difference. So his buck was pretty easy to sit, because when he'd lift his hindquarters up, it just made it even with the withers.
His buck was easy to sit.
The only thing about it was that he couldn't bend his backbone, so when he'd go sideways, he might leave you behind. But and his jump was terrible. But, oh, he was stupid.
How do they act, Barbara, when they're stupid?
They do stupid things, like this crazy buck of what was that horse's name? Something horrible. Little Pie. 17-3. His name was Little Pie.
Little boy. Little
man. Yeah. And he just acted stupid. He was the only horse I ever fooled into walking into a stall. You know, you can, if your horse won't go through a door, they say, well, you can lead him around in a circle and he'll go through, because a horse has one-track mind, and when you start him off on the circle, he forgets that didn't want to go through the door. Well, there aren't many horses that stupid. Little Pie was the only one I ever met that was that stupid.
He didn't know when he was going in a circle.
When he was going through the door. Well, Friend was never that stupid. Friend was another thoroughbred of the old school, long legs and rangy body. And he had been in an accident at starting gate that had ended his racing career. And he was another lovely old gray horse. Gray thoroughbreds are about the most sensible animals.
Oh.
They really do have good sense. I've never met a stupid gray.
Oh, that's nice. First gray is great.
First gray is young. But I really have never met what I consider to be a stupid gray horse. I met some very sensitive ones that required a lot of tact, but they weren't ever stupid. They were usually highly intelligent. But Friend wouldn't go through a stall door. He'd go up to it, and then he'd realize that it was narrow, and he'd panic. And he'd go about 3 steps backwards, and then he'd jump through. And the first time he did this, it was helpful if somebody warned you, because, you know, usually you walk through right in front of a horse. And could get landed on with Friend, because he would back up a couple of steps and then jump.
Mm.
But it wasn't because, it was because of that starting gate accident. He'd never forgotten it. And sometimes he'd get over it. If it was just one person he would working with him, he'd get over it, and he would go through all right. But when he was jumping and when he was hunting, he was the most generous horse. Just all that strength and spirit, he was willing to do, put it in any direction he wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he never fought you. The only time. As a rule, a thoroughbred will kick up a fuss and fight is when he's feeling good, and then he's not fighting, he's playing. They play rough, but they love it. And Friend had been like that. One of the girls who'd ridden him when he was younger said that he gave her the most embarrassing time she ever had. She went out on a cold morning, riding this great big old gray horse, and he was feeling good. Oh, he wanted to go. He really wanted to run. And they got right in front of this woman who had been somehow critical of Verdi's instruction. Verdi had taught this girl. And doggone, a Friend didn't whirl around and dump her on the fence. Right in front of this woman. But afterwards he put in a good hunt. He just needed to run to get settled down.
Well, she should have run a little bit.
Well, she should have, but you see, you don't want to do it before the hunt starts, because the hunt will last 4 hours. And most people depend on the first run in the hunt to settle the horses down.
Yes.
So when you go to a meet, you'll see a lot of these scatty thoroughbreds galloping, romping around looking stupid.
I see.
Now, personally, I prefer a half bred.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little thoroughbred.
Yeah. Well, half is all right, or even 3/4. But just a little something in there that'll give them good sense. They're willing, and they'll break their hearts for you, and they'll break their necks for you if they aren't careful.
Yeah.
And, that's the only problem with them. A lot of them are so. What was it? One of the great jumping people said that to make a great jumper, a horse had to be brave. And that's why most of the best jumpers in the world are thoroughbred. But he says, doggone it, a lot of thoroughbreds have too much courage. Because they aren't afraid of being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go through a jump and it won't hurt them. And so they aren't afraid of it. It'll hurt them, but they aren't afraid of being hurt. And it's a horse that's got that much heart that goes to the top and wins. But you also have to be careful they hurt themselves. They won't tell you. They won't let you know that they're hurt.
Oh.
There's many a thoroughbred that's raced on a sprained leg.
Mm-hmm. How's
it
doing?
They're spraining at the beginning of the race and they won't stop. And their jockeys can sit up there and do everything they want, but the horse won't stop. And Black Gold, back in 19, was it? He was in the 30s, wasn't he? Belonged to an Indian. And the Indian struck oil. So he named his colt Black Gold. And he raced him, and he would have been a Derby winner, except he was a Western horse, and they never shipped him east. But he was running in the Santa Anita Handicap. And he stepped on a piece of false ground towards the end of the race, and snapped his leg, just snapped the bone completely, and finished the race second on a broken leg. But that kind of courage will get you in trouble in the hunt field. You don't want a horse that's going to go and break a leg. So I like them to have a little more sense. I like a little quarter horse in them, because no quarter horse is going to go and put his foot where he'll break a leg.
Yeah, we just could get a good foal from Molly.
I think, guys, the thing that Sue talked about, she'd always worked with saddle horses. And after a year or so of working with thoroughbred, she was working with racing thoroughbreds.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had just thought about jumpers, you know, how little I knew. But I think her feeling about them was the way they trained them to race just simply made them silly.
That's
sort of silliness you're talking about. Just all they wanted to do was run.
Yes. How about that, Barbara?
Well, it's true, but for one thing, they're young horses, and they're fed, highly fed and highly trained, and they're in peak condition, and they're never given any experience.
Uh-huh.
They go from stall to the racetrack and back to the stall again, and they never learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
All they know is to run.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's it.
There's some people that make a business of buying up these colts that have raced a little bit and didn't do well, and retraining them for hunters and jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier now than it was. I mean, the horses are in better condition and that much harder to settle down. But it used to be those old long-rangey thoroughbreds. Now the breeding has changed and the breed is changing. And they're much better horses as far as I'm concerned. They're short coupled and stronger built. But so they make really good hunters and jumpers. And some of them are quite calm once you can get them away from the track and give them an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That occurred to me.
Now, I've met some really sensible thoroughbreds. When I say, you know, I like a half-bred better, well, you just couldn't get a better horse than Bold Ann. And I've seen some thoroughbred mares that would make Molly look like a hellion. They're just as sweet and just as quiet, and they're used to anything, any noise, anything happening. And some of the geldings the same way. But you have to figure, you've got to give them time. More than any other horse, they don't mature until they're 7 years old. All these poor little babies that they put out on the racetrack at two.
Really,
and the thoroughbred is the slowest maturing horse, mentally at any rate. When he's mature, when he's an 8 or 9 year old, with a lot of hunting experience, and a lot of experience at shows and traffic, is a wise horse. And if he's got a reasonable amount of intelligence, he's usually a very, very good horse. But
this fella down there crossing the standardbred, we might just check in with him.
Hmm. About to get my hands on a good yearling. Especially if it's got papers. If I spend the time with it, you can sell those things for hunters and jumpers in Virginia with papers and get $5,000 or $6,000 for them. If they're any good. They've got showing, what was it? There was a 3 or 4 year old, Rodney Jenkins had a 4 year old. Green working hunter. That means it was in its first year showing. Thoroughbred with papers. And it was absolutely beautiful, absolutely gorgeous confirmation. So one of my little friends saw this horse at Blowing Rock Horse Show. And she fell in love with it. It was just gorgeous. So it was for sale. She went trotting up to Jenkins' stables, and she went down the boxes, and sure enough, by this horse's box, they had it was for sale, and how much? $35,000. First year of hunting, and he'd probably never been behind a hunt. It was probably just in its first year of showing, and had never hunted behind hounds at all.
Of course, they may not have got it, but they could ask it.
They could ask it. They probably got it. And the person who buys it won't ride it. He'll leave it at Rodney Jenkins' stable at a fee of $150 to $200 a month for him to show and train.
You don't have to give it a lesson, things like that.
Not if I was good a rider as Rodney Jenkins, I wouldn't.
Oh, my children.
Yes, you can just get your banker to just train some of those horses.
Well, that's what I want to do, but I don't have any reputation.
You haven't got the horse, that's it.
Well, that's right. That's why I want a horse.
And you haven't got the bank account.
Tractor's running.
Keep the tractor's running.
Oh, Lord, isn't that awful?
You can tape, guys. There'll be enough to tape 24 hours a day.
Well, I'll tell you what I could do, except my nerves are not up to it. I turn on the radio. Well, tell me about that radio.
Barbara, you might as well. We'll not have any peace. I know the beginning.
Did you do that in cold blood? Or did you just slip up on it?
He can't get over it.
Poor defense of the horse.
And she didn't even ask the horses whether they liked rock and roll or not. That's the sad thing.
How did y'all get into that in the first place? Now, you didn't do that the whole shebang all the time?
She keeps it, yeah.
Yeah. Not 24 hours a day.
But ever since you started working with horses, you've had that machine going.
No. Not out at the dailies. Occasionally, Libby would bring hers over and play, but that was only very rarely. She only had a little tiny transistor and it wouldn't carry, so nobody ever listened to it, so it got turned off.
No.
and it tilts with radios were on it early in the morning for mucking out.
When did that start? 8 o'clock?
6:30 in the winter when all the horses were in. 8 o'clock in the summer when no horses in and you could do 2 stalls in 4 minutes. But,
and you did that to the radio?
Yeah. And then, see, part of it was that at first we mucked out 1 yard each. And there'd just be one person on the yard and you'd be working alone. So you'd have the radio on for company.
For company?
Yeah. I tried working without the radio and I'd get depressed. I'd realize how much work I was doing. And that was terrible.
Oh, really?
I had 5 stalls. To muck out, water, feed, bed down before breakfast. And mucking out is quite a chore. You could get out, you could practically take all the straw out and you use a couple of bales of straw to keep them properly bedded down.
In each horse?
No, for each horse. And you take at least half of that out every morning for each horse. So that could get to be quite a chore.
All that before breakfast?
Mm-hmm. So that's why I had the radio on. Keep me from thinking about what I was doing and getting depressed. And then we switched the system. We switched so that we all worked together. One person would muck out, one person bed down, one person water and feed and do all the other things. And one person would have to go down during the winter and do the pony boxes, which was another lonely job. With a lot, there were 10 pony stalls, straight stalls like you've got, for the little ponies. They just spent the night. They didn't stay in all day.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were messy. Those straight stalls, horribly messy. And one person could do them in the time it took the others to muck out 25 horses. One person would do the 10 ponies. But we kept the radio on, all during mucking out. And then after breakfast, I usually had the radio on when I was grooming and when I was milking the cows. The cow definitely liked it. She always gave more milk when I had the radio on. Don't shake your head. It's true. Because that was family choice. Now, that family choice was about Amanda's speed, I guess, or Abigail's speed.
Oh.
Children's songs and and that. They'd play the number one pop tunes and things like that occasionally, but a lot of it was children's songs and Irish people like that would be like Perry Como and that sort of singer in this country.
But you just had to take what they gave you on the television, on the radio.
Yeah, occasionally, very very rarely, I'd switch over to BBC 4. They almost always had classical music on. But it didn't work too well, because if there were 3 radios in the yard on Radio 1, and my radio on Radio 4, it didn't. It would clash occasionally.
Oh, would it?
Yeah.
It'd be noticeable?
Yeah, it'd be noticeable if any of them were turned up. Usually I just kept it on 1.
So if yours was loud, they could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
If theirs loud, you couldn't hear yours.
That's right. But see, now in the morning you usually kept them down pretty low. It was just you listening to it. They were up loud for mucking out, because you'd usually have one radio on the yard. And only one on. And then when we were grooming or something like that, we each had our own radio with us, in the stall with us, and they would turn down low. Really low.
Got a good big 4-inch one?
Mm-hmm. Be a problem sometimes.
No way to set it.
Well, I had a place in Silverstall. I put it on the window ledge. And he had a grill in his window, and I put it behind the grill. He couldn't bother. And then I got in the habit of putting it on his automatic watering bowl. I'd keep an eye on it. He never touched it, but I'd keep an eye on it. I was always scared to death he was going to knock it over in the water. He never did. He never touched it. He wouldn't even look at it. Candy was the only one that ever gave me problems about that. He'd reach up and pull it off the ledge.
Well, yeah. That was just your dissipation. You might as well dip snuff or something.
This channel one over. Channel one over. Monday at breakfast, 8th of December, 69, Channel 1 over 375. Channel 1 over 375 at breakfast. At breakfast, Monday, the 8th of December, 69. At Monday, the 8th of December, 69. Channel 1 over 375. Channel 1 over 375 at breakfast. Monday, the 8th of December, 69.
Well, now, Barbara, here's the thing. With all these fine people that you work with, you see, you saw them mostly in a pleasant, favorable light, and that's the way we talk. But you still have to put up with a lot, and they all have got ways of doing things that just get on people's nerves.
I was telling Faye, I was looking through the paper this morning, or this evening, and there was a little note in there about the former Bishop Pike's widow speaking at some sort of engagement, and I hadn't even realized he was dead, much less his widow would be speaking at an engagement someplace. And I was trying to figure out how I'd miss such a thing, and we finally figured out that it was during while I was in England. And the thing about it is that we just never listened to the news, and we didn't get a newspaper. And sometimes you can really feel cut off, but there wasn't anybody, most of us weren't interested in the news, and if you're going to have six people talking, it's not worth turning it on to listen to, so... Most of the time, we simply didn't turn it on.
Well, now, that just wasn't their taste, the news?
No, public affairs, anything. As far as TV went, what they liked to watch was Love Story. We watched that every week.
At night?
Oh, yeah. And, movies, all the old movies. And, there were a couple of other things similar to Love Story on between BBC and One and ITV. But if you wanted to listen to a documentary, you might as well give up, unless you could get them all off to a pub or something. I lucked onto a couple. They were off at a pub, and I had the TV on, and I remember Elaine was with me. And all the rest had gone out. And this program started, and she came, and she, I wasn't paying too much attention. She says, "You want to watch this?" And I looked up, and it was on Andre Previn. I said, "Yes." She went, "Oh." So she went into the kitchen to fix her supper, and this is at 11 o'clock at night. She went in to fix her supper. And I watched a program on Andre Frevin. It was a very interesting program. And another night, Jane and I got left and everybody else was off, and there happened to be a program on the life of Degas. But I never would have gotten to hear it if there had been anybody else around. She was really interested in that program on Deegan. She would have been interested. She was sorry she missed the one on Previn. She had wanted to see it. But that side of her never came out in front of the others.
Oh.
I don't think I was probably the only one she ever talked about music with. Her father was played flute, and she played flute. And she said that, as far as she knew, among all her father's friends, all the doctors were musicians. That's what they did as their hobbies. And all her father's friends were musicians. But she never talked about music in front of the others. And one day when she was in Stratford, she found a copy of a record of The Planets by Holst. And she bought it. She said that her brother had brought it home, and she had liked it, so she brought it, bought it, and brought it, left it in the club room. And she was sitting watching TV when Elaine came in. Elaine walked over, and she said, "Oh, good, you bought new records," because that was always something exciting, buy new records, you know. And she went through them, and there was one pop record, and then there was this one on The Planets. She looked at it and she snorted. "It's Barbara's." Jane tightened a little. She said, "No." "Oh." "Trudy's?" "No." "Oh." "Yours?" "Yes." So Elaine sort of, when she got caught in a situation like that, she'd say, "Oh, well, I like classical music." So we put the record on the next day, and we especially wanted to hear the Venus. I think it was either Venus or Mercury we wanted to hear before we had to go into Stratford. So we had the record on, and Elaine came in, and her expression changed noticeably when she heard what was on. And Janie and I noted and didn't say anything. And Janie says, we went into the kitchen, left Elaine sitting in the club room because we knew what was going to happen anyway. And Jane says, "How long do you think it's going to take her to change that record when we leave?" So we had to run catch the bus. We always skimmed it so close, we always had to run catch the bus. And we said, "Goodbye, Elaine," and tromped up the passage, and 4 seconds flat, that record was off. And by the time we reached the end of the passage, she had this record I couldn't, that I got so sick of on.
But once you framed up on Elaine,
she kept playing this record. I can't remember the name of the man who sings it now. He's got a good voice and he sings good lyrics, and they're mostly pretty strong and simple. And that's sort of good to listen to. It's the kind of record you put on occasionally. It's not a thing you listen to every day. It's, for one thing, it's a bit too pure. You can't take it too much of it. But Elaine never was bothered by repetition. And once she would get hold of a record, and when she first bought it, you would hear it night and day until she got another one. And so she put this one on, and one of the songs on it, remember that song, "I'll Buy You One More Orange Juice." It's a nice song. This title doesn't sound too great, but it's a nice song. And it had been high in the hit parade, and that already meant that it had been overplayed. Since we always had the radios on all the time, by the time one made the hit parade, you'd heard it about a couple hundred times. And she bought this LP and played it constantly. And I liked it at first. Thought it was a great LP. I liked it when I left. But in between, I got so sick of it, just hearing it. And I was going through one of my anti-Elaine periods when I was beginning to get a little sick of Elaine. All she had to do put that record on for me to get jittery. You know, you can just get to the point where if one person walks into the room, you just go tense and every muscle tightens. And I was at that point. And one day, Trudy came in. She said, "I haven't heard this record in a while." I said, "Okay, put it on." "I haven't heard it in maybe 24 hours." So she put it on. And she got halfway through it, and Jane came in. So when it finished playing, Jane said, "Well, flip it back over so that I can hear the other side." So she flipped it back over, and I heard the other side again. And it just about finished, and Elaine came in. Elaine had to play it again. By that time, I was getting a little sick of the record. I'd heard it 3 times already, and I about had enough. So I was sitting over at the table, scribbling away or studying or something. Stupid. Horrible. And I looked up and I said, "Elaine, don't you ever get sick of anything?" "I like this record." I said, "No, but don't you think it ever gets played a little more than it should?" Well, now, you see, that kind of language wouldn't get through to Elaine. You could talk to her like that for an hour and a half and it'd never get through to her what the point was. No, it wouldn't. I used to have her on for about 5 or 10 minutes before I'd let her in on what I was talking about. Poor Trudy would be in hysterics over in a corner someplace.
Oh.
But you couldn't be very subtle with Elaine, expect it to really get over. That's why it could be. You can tease her a good bit.
How do you get to the point then?
I say something like, I finally said, "Well, you know, Elaine, I've heard that record about, I'd say something like roughly 20 times in the last 2 days." She said, "Well, I like it. I want to hear it again." And she flipped the side over. And I said, about that time I could see she wasn't going to take my point. So I went to my room and studied German or something. I don't know.
Well, she won.
Well, sure she won. It was her record player. It was a losing battle before I started.
Put it this way, the daytime it was all right. It was after hours at night where all this lack of taste in art that Whitman talks about, you know, that was his great disappointment in his comrades.
Well, in the daytime you were working. And you see now, this little in the daytime you could expect people to see. I never forget one time when we were working and we had started off in the winter and we were having to get up at 6:30, and that was before sunrise. That was about an hour before sunrise.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden these two girls came charging around. It was Margaret, the one I complained about being so loud and anti anything but British.
Oh, is
so
she the
pro
one?
British.
Oh, is she the one?
Yeah, she.
You didn't call her name.
Well, so, yeah.
Yeah.
See, she was only there for about the first 6 months I was there. But she and Sarah, the one from the racing stable, came charging around. They said, "Barbara, you've got to get your camera." I thought, "Huh? 6:30? It's dark. What do you mean I got to go get my camera?" And they said, "No, you've got to. Come here." And it was snow. It was snow. It had snowed the night before. Well, several days before. There was still snow on the ground. And they went charging around, dragging me behind them. And they said, "Now look at this. You've got to get a picture of this." And what it was the moon was just setting. The dawn was just coming up in the east. And the moon was just setting in the west. And it was setting behind a tree. There was just this one lone tree. And it was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And there were clouds. There was just enough cloud to catch the light around it. What looked a bit like if I had gotten a good picture of it, it would have looked like a sunset. That sort of clouds, not the misty clouds. Just beautiful. But Margaret's taste in records. Absolutely, she had absolutely no sense of literature at all. None at all. I don't think she ever read a book in her life.
Now, she was at...
Belt. She was John Bull, I guess.
Bull,
yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
John Bull. It's the only way I can think of saying
yeah.
it. Anything British was better than anything made in the world, and anything not British was automatically inferior.
And she talked through the performance.
Yeah, we were watching show jumping, and she talked. She would talk and chatter. Oh, and she was loud. She never kept her voice down at all, and she would shout through the whole thing, running down all the horses that weren't British, and all the while. Now, see, she had a chance. If she had opened her eyes and looked, she had a chance to watch two or three of the best riders in the world ride magnificent rounds. One of them was William Steinkraus, our team captain. The other was German. Just beautiful rounds. But while Bill Steinkraus was riding and this other fellow, she was telling us how great and how terrific the captain of the British team was. Now, he's a man of dubious reputation, I'll tell you right now. He's a rough and ready sort of chap who makes a mint jumping show horses and says he's in it only for the money. He's as professional as they come, and he was captain of the show jumping team at the Olympic Games, which is supposed to be purely amateur. He can keep his amateur rating because Britain's rating system is different from that in the United States. And he's admittedly a strong rider and can get a horse to jump, but he's also been often, his methods have often been questioned. Rather than, most people feel that rather than using the proper methods to build a horse up, he'll use something cruel or a shock or something like that to get him to jump. And Margaret was, for that reason, I think, was one reason Margaret was building him up so much. Now, the British are about show jumping the way people are about football and basketball here.
Really?
Yes, ma'am. They put it on TV every little event is on TV. And show jumping riders have their followers and their fans. And they'll get in fights about it.
Oh.
You see, whether Peter Robinson is better than Harvey Smith. Now, Harvey Smith is the fellow that was captain of the team. He's a, and
we hardly know the jumpers.
Yeah. Nobody ever hears of the jumpers here, but in England, they're popular sports heroes. And Harvey Smith has a following. He also has a whole group of people that are very much against him. And it's strong. And see, now Margaret could not hear a word against Harvey Smith. And Judy and Celia think he's the worst bottom of the barrel. And all the time that she could have been watching really great riders like Steinkraus ride, or Schillemoka, the German, or even Peter Robertson, the British rider, top British rider. I mean, he's a beautiful rider, classic, and he has good performances. All she could do was talk and not even look at the TV screen. She was so busy talking loudly about how great Harvey Smith was. And the unfortunate thing about it was the only thing Judy could think of to say was, he's a builder. That put it all in a nutshell as far as she was concerned. He was a builder. A great, big, heavy businessman. Thick set, rough on his horses.
Now that was Judy.
That was Judy. Now you see, Judy's the one that's so terribly, she really is snobbish. And for as far as all she felt she needed to say was that Harvey Smith was a builder, and that would satisfy it. Celia said he was cruel to his horses. And, but as far as Margaret was concerned,
I don't remember that you said Judy was snobbish.
Well, it's on the tape somewhere. I did. I'm sure I must have, because that's one of the. The thing was, she could confuse it so much with money. It was all money and class. This was what I thought was so sad about it. It was all one to Judy. And there is so much class distinction in England. It's there. Nobody can say it's not there. But for Judy, she didn't have even the proper English values for it. She thought that those boys that she was going out with, her cricketers, she really thought she was going out with somebody high class. And they were nothing but a bunch of lazy, hot rodders. That's all they were, would be in this country. And but they were rich. They had money.
Oh, they did?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Oh, yeah, they had money. Well, the sports cars they raced. One of the boys had a Lotus. And you don't have a car like that. Lotus Racer, that's one of the really purely racing cars.
Is that like some of this car Nick drives?
No. I mean one of the Grand Prix cars. Not a stock car.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
Oh, she was just in high society then.
Well, she thought she was. And you see, the crowd that she'd gone with before that were all the hunting crowd. And they could all talk about the points and the hunts and the... This is all, of course, very high class, too.
Yeah.
And she would come down to the stable and she would say, for instance, she would talk to us and she said, I never used to associate with the students. It's nice. And it was true. She felt that we were a higher grade of student than had been there before. And she never used to associate with them. She'd always go out with her own friends, her hunting friends and so forth. And then she started out with this other crowd.
No, I just took that they were sort of like the barge people.
No.
Just rowdies, you know, 20 years old, rowdy or less.
No, they were cricketers. I said that. But you've got to realize that people that play cricket belong to a certain class. People that play cricket in cricket clubs in Sully Hall of Birmingham.
Yeah.
It's something you don't catch unless you sort of. I didn't realize, for instance, if somebody had told me that by walking into an English pub, you could tell within 3 seconds what class pub it was. Just simply by taking a quick glance around at the people in it, I would have said, you're joking. But it's true. Walking to the Dirty Duck. Quick glance. Actors and riffraff. It's sad that they go together, but they do. And it's not the good actors from the it's the bit players from over at the theater, which is right across the road. You walk over to the other side, and it's all the tourists and people down from London, because the Dirty Duck is famous. Going to the bar at the Falcon, and it's mostly cricket people, not cricket people from the same group, older, and looked like a lot of university people. And every one of them in their turtleneck shirts, all the boys in turtleneck and sports jacket. And all looking terribly clean and proper.
That's university?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know enough university. Didn't meet enough university students. And I didn't go to the Falcon but once. I could just by glancing around, I could tell it was all one sort of people, though, and they had folk music there. They'd have a groups come in that would do live entertainment during the evening, all folk music. Then the Hampton Lucy pub wasn't really. Now this is always going into the lounge, not going back for the where the locals go. Hampton Lucy pub was not. Was farmers, but it wasn't the worker. It was the farmers' owners, property owners. And it was a local pub, whereas the town pubs weren't particularly local. And I was simply amazed. It hit me hardest when I walked into the bar of the Falcon. Because I've never seen such conformity.
Hmm. Was that the turtlenecks?
Mm-hmm.
Who briefed you on what to look for in those places?
Well, nobody. Directly. Trudy, I think, mentioned that she felt the English were more class conscious. And of course, you run into it all the time in literature, but I don't believe half of what I read, unless I've seen it. And, Trudy, you see, has been around both Americans and English.
Yeah.
In Bangkok, she's around Americans, mostly army people, but a lot of Americans, and she's been in the States, and she's lived in England, and been in British schools. And she's observant. She's a pretty bright girl.
But you didn't go with her.
No, I didn't go with her, and besides, I never taught when I went any place. There's very rarely, even when I went to the Falcon with Peter when I was going out with him for a little bit, but we just sat and had our drinks. We didn't talk much.
Just looked.
And when I went to some of these other places, I wasn't with anybody, and I can't hear. I get in a pub, for instance, like the Dirty Dutch, I can't hear the person next to me talking. And so I can't take part in the conversations. I just have to sit and look. It's not because I'm antisocial, I just can't hear. And I reckon. I know several times I hated going to the Duck. And Elaine was wild about the Duck. Mainly because some of her riffraff friends, she had an odd idea of what sort of boys she wanted to go after. And Pete, the first boy she introduced us to, because she was the only one that knew anybody, Pete and another boy, and Dave Atwater. Dave Atwater at least had a job. He worked over at the theater as a props boy and bit player and talked great things about wanting to act, but he wasn't much.
Just talk pretty well.
Just big.
Pete wrote poetry. Couldn't keep a job. He had a job at the one of the big hotels as a busboy or something like that. And the last time I saw him, he was cooking at some long, stringy, dirty hair, and he was cooking at some restaurant and talking about how he was going to immigrate to Australia. He wrote very poor poetry. And then she fell in with Sid, and Sid had a friend who was tall and beautiful, and very, very sensitive, and freaked out. Most of Sid's friends were freaked out, but that was, matter of fact, Sid himself was freaked out. He freaked out on booze. His friend freaked out on drugs. And booze. And she just went head over heels over this boy. And she knew that he was occasionally seen at the Duck. Now, you girls alone don't go to a pub unless it's a local pub where they go all the time. Yet she would go after a movie. She would want to go to the Duck. And somehow, we never could convince her that it was being in somehow forward to go charging after a boy like that. And this poor boy ran every time he saw her. I could see him. Look at, one time we came up to the Duck and he was standing...